Welcome to TWIL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on October 13th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore in Baltimore, Maryland.
So, Frank, today we welcome Professor Deirdre Madden. Professor Madden is Professor of Law at University College Cork in the Republic of Ireland. She's one of Europe's leading bioethicists, a prolific scholar, and frankly, sort of one of those people that smart government agencies turn to when there is some sort of tricky issue to be investigated or reported on. If you look at some of the literature in EU health, her fingerprints are all over some of the more important commissions and national reports on bioethics, privacy, consent, and so on. Big welcome, Deirdre.
Thank you very much. That's a very kind introduction.
Well, here at TWIL, we try and confront some of the knotty problems of the day, and I know you're going to help us with some of them. But first, a couple of issues I want to follow on from episode 28, and regular listeners might remember we talked then to the DC privacy lawyer, Kirk Nara. The first of those is meaningful use, which is the sort of ultimate inside baseball issue for HIT lawyers in the US. So after a lot of delay, we now seem to have some final rule changes for both stages one and two, and the new stage three rules, plus the new certification rule with regard to the actual hardware. And these obviously all came out of CMS and ONC. The big surprise, I suppose, is that stage three came out at all, because the political indicators were suggesting that there was going to be quite a delay in that demanded by Congress. So we'll see exactly whether there's an intervention on that point. But overall, we have the new standards for the use of electronic medical health records. The transition from the current subsidy slash penalty model to the new merit value system is not really incorporated in this yet, so we'll likely see some changes and tweaks on that. The earlier stages have been dumbed down quite a lot, particularly for those for stage three, stage two. Stage three, I think, is interesting in that it allows APIs, application programming interfaces, as an alternative route to patient portals to sort of facilitate sharing of data from providers to patients. But that in itself raises all sorts of nasty issues, because as the API takes the data from the electronic health record, the provider's record, and dumps it over to a patient place, then I think at the same time it strips that data of its HIPAA protection, with all the kinds of issues there. Under the certification provisions, it looks like vendors have been given a lot of extra time this time to develop their software, primarily to try and improve interoperability. But I also noticed there were some renewed data segmentation requirements. Overall, it's important. It's still controversial. And I think we have to wait for the 21st Century Cures Act early next year, maybe, to see particularly what's going to happen with regard to interoperability, see if Congress actually gets stuck in there. Clearly, the controversy, the slowdowns in some of the objectives and so on, do suggest that we still have considerable problems in coming up with a coherent electronic health record strategy in this country, and more importantly, perhaps, coherent and universal adoption and implementation to get us where we want to be. And sometimes I think maybe in all of this we forget where we want to be. Very quickly, Deirdre, I noticed that you had co-authored Ireland's report to the EU on the state of EHRs. And cribbing from the executive summary, quote, there is no comprehensive national system of EHRs in operation in Ireland at this time, but electronic records exist in the large majority of general practice settings and in other hospitals and clinics, unquote. And one of the barriers your report cited was the lack of, quote, a legal framework, unquote, for electronic health records. And that's something that we struggle with here. And I wonder if you could just sort of outline very broadly what you mean by a legal framework in your context.
Well, I suppose, as the report says, Nick, there isn't any legislative basis for any joined up thinking or any coherent way in which these electronic health records, which currently exist in general practice, could be joined together or that they could be linked into hospital systems. We don't have any basis for doing that, I suppose, is what we mean. There is a proposal to have a Health Information Act introduced in Ireland shortly, but to be honest, that's been on the cards for at least 5 years, and we've seen various iterations and versions of it over the years. And the basis for that, or the thinking behind that, is to put the foundations in place to enable electronic health records to be introduced. But I think possibly for economic reasons, because Ireland, as you know, went through somewhat of a downturn in its economy over the last number of years. And I think it was feared that that we wouldn't be able to afford to introduce electronic health records at this time. We're still hoping that the Health Information Act will come in to at least put the framework in place so that when we do have the financial resources, that we can actually bring electronic health records in, but we're still waiting.
So it tends to be a financial issue at the moment, because I think rather glibly from over here, we say, you know, how much easier it is to have electronic health records, to have full interoperability when you have a fully integrated healthcare system such as Ireland's. But I guess we also have to bear in mind the budgetary issues as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think certainly the interoperability and the efficiency and the patient safety and quality assurance aspects of all of this, I think, are pretty much accepted by all the policymakers, by the Departments of Health and everything else. But it's just a matter of not being able to afford it at the moment, I think.
So another issue that we previewed on that prior episode now has come to pass. We talked then about the Advocate General's opinion in the Facebook case. And indeed, the European Court of Justice has now followed the lead of the Advocate General and struck down essentially the EU-US data protection safe harbor, which was actually a commission decision as far as the actual sort of legislative piece that was killed by the court. So the case is Maximilian Schrems versus the Data Protection Commissioner, the Data Protection Commissioner of Ireland, incidentally. Schrems is a well-known Austrian privacy advocate and a longtime campaigner against Facebook's privacy practices. So Facebook has its servers in Ireland, and that's where sort of EU Facebook data first is dumped. But then much of the data processing, and I think this is true also of Google, which also I believe has major servers in Ireland, and Microsoft. But much of the data processing is performed after the data are shifted from Ireland over to US servers. And of course, that data flow was protected under the safe harbor. And Schrems argued that the safe harbor allowing such data transfers was invalid because it wasn't sufficiently protective of his privacy, in particular after the Snowden revelations about NSA access to such data in the US. And the European Court of Justice, struck me in a very strong opinion, said that only private parties, not US government agencies, were bound by the safe harbor, and said that this and the inability of national authorities to check these data transfers breached fundamental privacy and judicial protections of citizens, and essentially instructed Deirdre, your data protection agency, to, if you like, perform case-by-case determinations of the adequacy of the protection of the data being exported from the EU. Now, dear listeners who are healthcare lawyers, you may be saying, oh great, so what? Well, a couple of things, I think. First of all, this seems to be another sign that with the US unable to agree on strong data protection again across all sectors in this country, very much the center of gravity of privacy is continuing to shift to the EU, and that's likely to be confirmed when the new data protection regulation is passed. Second, a large number of health data or fellow traveler companies were sheltering in this safe harbor, including some major electronic health record developers, pharmaceutical manufacturers, and friends of the show, particularly of Frank and I, leading data brokers. So they, Facebook and Google, are now trying to figure out how to satisfy EU data protection agencies using some different model. Or if they're unable to, then that probably messes up some of their business models because they can't combine their EU data with their US data, which presumably lowers the value of that data overall. So a fascinating decision from our side of the pond, Deirdre. I wondered what kind of press or academic response there'd been in Ireland or more generally in the EU.
Well, I think that, I suppose, from my point of view, where the concern would be is in relation to medical research and multi-jurisdictional research. As you know, I'm sure the EU funds research through its framework programs and now Horizon 2020, and it allows for multi-party, very large and very important research projects where data would be crossing borders, not only within the EU, but obviously to outside of the EU as well, and particularly into the United States. So I think that they're going to certainly have to rethink that, because the whole framework program of Horizon 2020 currently allows the export of data to the United States under those safe harbor principles. So I think that's something that's going to certainly affect medical research. And as you mentioned, the commissioner are currently in the process of agreeing a new data protection regulation. And I think that's very interesting in the sense that they've chosen a regulation rather than a directive. So for those who aren't familiar with it, I suppose a directive is just the agreement in principle that all of the EU member states would agree to transpose the principles of a particular directive into their own national law by introducing legislation. In choosing a directive, I suppose the Commission of the European Union is recognising that there's a little bit of room for manoeuvre or wriggle room within each national state's jurisdiction to interpret the principles of the directive in a particular way to suit their own culture, while still, of course, trying to harmonise in terms of the overall principles. Whereas now what they've chosen to do is a data protection regulation in which there's no wriggle room or no room for manoeuvre. It's of direct effect in each member state. So each member state, the idea is that all of the member states will have the same data protection rules, which is designed to make the markets flow more easily. It's designed to make the transfer of data between EU member states more seamless and thereby contribute better to the economy. So I think that in drafting this new regulation, they're obviously going to have to bear in mind the implications of the Schrems case and the safe harbour principles. So we'll have to wait and see how that works out.
And just to follow up a bit on the safe harbor and sort of the bigger picture of EU privacy regulation, do you think that there are concrete ways in which health privacy interests or the other interests protected by privacy laws are set to be better protected in Europe thanks to developments like this recent sort of trouble with the safe harbor or the regulation that you just discussed? Or do you think that ultimately this is going to be a lot of sound and fury signifying not so much, that the pressure of globalization and international harmonization, say through even things like the TPP or other trade agreements, will overcome efforts by either the EU itself or individual nations or states within it to carve out distinctive approaches to privacy and autonomy?
That's an interesting question. I think that the balance, as you say, between the competing interests, one of the aims of the regulation that's being introduced now is specifically to strengthen the digital privacy rights of EU citizens. And also at the same time, one of the other aims is to improve Europe's online economy and strengthen the free market. So they recognize, I think, the competing interests and values, even in the aims of the regulation. I think in terms of the way in which the regulation is currently drafted and the version that we have available to us at the moment, it's certainly, and I'm particularly interested in the research aspects of it and the health research aspects of it, they certainly seem to be tightening up a lot more in terms of the privacy aspects of it, even though that may have negative implications for research. And obviously research has then got implications for the economy and so on, and competitiveness in the world stage. But some of the ways in which they're tightening up in terms of privacy are in relation to consent. So, for example, the current draft says that you can process personal data concerning health for research purposes only with the consent of the data subject, that's the person who owns the data, and that member states may be able to introduce exceptions to that only where the research serves a high public interest and if the research cannot possibly be carried out otherwise. Now, those are very high bars being set for research. This concept of high public interest suggests that that kind of exception will be used only in a very limited set of circumstances, and that's going to be very problematic for a lot of studies, because the results and the impact of the study, of course, won't be known at the outset when you start it. You don't know, you know, the extent to which it will be of a high public interest, because you don't know what your results are going to be. And also, this idea that it can't possibly be carried out otherwise, creates also a very strict test that does not take into account the nature of research. And then they also have a requirement that if you can't completely anonymize the data, that you must pseudonymize it. And that has to be at the highest technical standards. So they seem to be on a number of fronts, putting the privacy rights perhaps ahead of economic interests or competitiveness. So maybe the pendulum has swung in that direction rather than in the opposite one, as we've discussed.
Those are really interesting developments that I'm sure our listeners are going to be fascinated by, particularly in the context of, our American audience still working through the notice of proposed rulemaking that was put forward with respect to a lot of human subjects research by many agencies early in September. It's quite a saga in the U.S. There was an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, I think, 4 years ago, where essentially the agencies were realizing that the common rule here needed to be updated to take account for new research opportunities. And now we have the notice of proposed rulemaking. But just working through it, I share some of the same concerns that you have on the European front, just because of the complexity, particularly in areas like quality improvement and what is defined as research and what is not. I think this is going to, there are definitely some concerns about chilling effects, and that perhaps is what is spurring the 21st Century Cures Act as well, or aspects of it. Now, if we could drill down a bit into the research area, I've just been so fascinated by your work in it, Deirdre, and particularly if you could introduce our listeners to the problem of the Guthrie cards, because we have on stateside, there was the problem in Texas in 2009 of millions of cards being destroyed that had blood samples. There was worries about a biobank by stealth being accumulated. And I'm wondering if you might be able to comment on a similar controversy that's been happening and sort of the current state of play there.
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is an interesting controversy that arose not only in Ireland, but it has also currently been discussed in other European jurisdictions as well. So you're obviously familiar with the concept of newborn screening and what it is and why it's done. This idea that there's a small heel prick test done of the newborn infant, and that's done in order to screen them for very serious disease. And the blood spot is kept on a card, which is referred to as a Guthrie card. So it's essentially just a piece of filter paper that's used to store a small sample of dried blood. And those Guthrie cards are potentially valuable in testing for lots of different conditions now, such as cystic fibrosis and various others. So there are issues on the one hand about whether screening should be mandatory or not. And then there are other issues, I suppose, in relation to privacy about how and to how long you keep the cards for. Do you need consent to keep the cards? Can they be used for other purposes? So what happened in the Irish context was that there was a complaint made to our data protection commissioner a couple of years ago that these Guthrie cards were being kept or had been kept for many years without consent. So parents, when the heel prick test was done, were being asked for consent to have the test done, but they were not being informed that the dried blood spot was being kept essentially in an archive, such as you might describe it as a biobank, I suppose. They were being kept in this archive indefinitely. And the data protection commissioner said that this violated data protection rights and that therefore all of the Guthrie cards had to be destroyed. So at that time, there were approximately 1.5 million cards in storage in Ireland. They had been kept from the newborn screening started in 1966 in Ireland. It was one of the first countries to introduce it. So there was 1.6 million cards in storage. And until 2011, parents were not being asked for consent to keep them. So the Data Protection Commissioner said this was a violation of data protection law. So the Minister for Health ordered that all of these cards should be destroyed unless individuals requested them back. And there was a big controversy, I suppose, and a big outcry from public health clinicians and from cardiologists in particular in relation to the destruction of these cards, because they said that they could use these newborn screening cards for genetic testing. And the example that they gave was that this sudden cardiac death, which strikes down people in their late teens or early 20s, and there doesn't appear to be any particular reason for the death. They're otherwise normal, healthy individuals. And an autopsy may be carried out on those people, and which shows normal results. And it turns out that they've died from something like sudden arrhythmic death syndrome. And when as further studies have been done in New Zealand and in Ireland, and it shows that in about a third of those cases, the deceased have had a genetic condition called long QT syndrome. And the cardiologists are saying that if we can keep these cards, we may be able to detect from those cards whether the deceased died from long QT syndrome, and therefore you can screen the other family members to see whether they also have it, and protective measures can be taken for them. So they're saying there's a real diagnostic issue in keeping these cards. It's not just about keeping the cards for research, because of course research can be carried out on unidentifiable or anonymous cards, but you do need to have the identity if you want to use it for diagnostic purposes. So they're saying that if you can keep the cards in an identifiable format, you could perhaps save the lives of the 100 or so young people who die in Ireland every year from sudden adult death syndrome or sudden cardiac death. So the minister at that point, having listened to all of these submissions, paused the destruction order pending advice from our Attorney General. About 30,000 cards have been returned to individuals who requested them back. As I understand it, the Attorney General's advice certainly hasn't been made public at this point, but my own view of it is that it would not take a huge effort in order to keep the cards, because you just have to pass a short piece of legislation exempting the archive from data protection legislation. It's just about having the political will, I suppose, to do it.
That is a really fascinating dilemma that has been raised there. And I know that after the 5 million cards were destroyed in Texas, I think many people were deeply worried about that and upset. The other thing that I was sort of wondering about here is, two things. One is, in discussions of the learning healthcare system in the United States, at least the ones that I've been privy to, I found it relatively rare for those who are involved in trying to either bank tissue to do, you know, further tissue biobanking or to do other big data research on health records. They seem to be reluctant to try to put into the consent form some type of effort to inform the patient that this exactly the type of scenario that you described could happen, whereby a rare genetic variant could be found, you know, years or decades down the road that could help them. It's strange to me because to me it seems as though if you really want to build buy-in into the learning healthcare system, that's exactly what you would emphasize. And moreover, you would try to design systems to promote that type of issue, that type of finding. It reminds me a bit of Susan Wolf's work on incidental findings, where she's been encouraging, you know, much more ethical attention to scenarios in medical research where there's an incidental finding and that could have deep diagnostic significance. The other side of the coin that I'm just wondering about is, you know, looking at from the United States context, the Fourth Amendment, most lawyers are familiar with the exclusionary rule, but there are many, and that certainly applies to criminal context when there's sort of an illegal search and seizure, but in administrative agency contexts, in many of them, there's nothing like the exclusionary rule. There are potential penalties, but, you know, you don't necessarily have to destroy or, you know, just get rid of the evidence. And I'm wondering, you know, if they had brainstormed possibly alternate remedies, or if the statute or whatever the controlling legal authority basically dictated destruction absent contrary legislation. So to recap, and sorry for those very long questions, but I'm just wondering, you know, do you think that emphasis in the consent forms on potential personal help will be part of the future of, say, learning healthcare systems? And secondly, do you think there was any room here for a remedy that was not quite so severe?
Well, I think certainly in relation to the design of consent forms, I think that's something that would be very much welcome. And I think that part of the problem here is that perhaps representatives of the public interest maybe were not involved and traditionally are not involved in the governance of these sorts of issues and in relation to design of consent forms, because I think it's hugely important that whatever we do, we maintain public trust in the screening program and that we don't jeopardize that by sloppy design of consent forms or by poor governance structures, because we need to have the screening programs in order to protect people's health. And I think there's a real benefit for the public interest in having members of the public or representatives of the public interest involved in the design of these consent forms. I think part of the problem is in knowing in advance, you know, the uses to which these cards might be put. So in 1966, when this program was initially developed, they had no concept of the possible uses to which these cards might be put in 2015. And so they didn't cover that base, I suppose. And they just thought, look, we'll just keep them just in case. And they didn't really think through the possible research angles or the diagnostic possibilities at that time. And then I suppose the other argument is that, you know, it's obviously very difficult to think about future uses. And if you have a provision in your consent form that seeks consent for all possible future uses, you have the argument then that that's not really consent at all. It's too general, it's too broad, and it's not specific enough to be to explicitly cover the future use that you might seek in the following years. So I think there's that problem. There's also a problem that I'm not sure if it arose in the United States, but it certainly affected a couple of countries in Europe in relation to, we had a controversy a number of years ago about postmortems and about the retention of organs and tissue following postmortem without the consent of family members. And it was particularly marked and sensitive in relation to postmortem examinations carried out on children who had died in hospital. And so what happened was that the postmortem examinations that took place when a child died in hospital or unexpectedly, the pathologist retained in some cases whole organs and in other cases parts of organs and tissue, and they kept them indefinitely, and the families only found out about that through a public inquiry in the United Kingdom. And there was a huge degree of distrust built up, I suppose, around those sorts of practices and around retention of tissue, because these organs and tissue were kept for 20 or 30 years without the consent and knowledge of the families, sometimes kept in very poor conditions, kept in buckets in pathology labs, and it caused huge distress and trauma to family members who then discovered that they, as they thought, had not buried their child intact and that the parts of their child were still lying in a hospital somewhere. So that also, I suppose, complicates the picture in relation to privacy and in relation to consent and in relation to the use of tissue. I'm not sure if that issue was a controversy in the United States, but it certainly affected Ireland, the United Kingdom, Scotland and others.
I think that's almost a perfect metaphor, really, for so many of our privacy issues now confronted by rapidly evolving technologies, that we make privacy or privacy-like or consent-like, because they're both derived from autonomy after all, consent-like decisions in one context, only for that decision to perhaps look rather controversial once a new technology has appeared. So when I look at US newborn screening laws, I'm not sure we can be much help to you, Deirdre, as far as models. They are beyond varied in their types. Some prohibit any use. Some require the destruction of the cards after the initial test. Some permit very robust uses. Some of those robust uses are premised on an opt-out, some with an opt-in, and so on. But if you kind of, you know, if you did the health law exam question for your students, and you know, you picked on sort of legal questions like the initial consent to the procedure, the informed consent to data retention, sharing of data, which is generally, I think, permitted in the U.S. under HIPAA with public health authorities, even though it's those are not de-identified samples. What happens to residual screening samples and problems of discrimination, forensics? What are the laws as to retention of the data and property interests? I'm sure you could make a longer. Your answer would be a first. Mine will be a gentleman's lower second. I'm sure you'd make a longer list, but of that sort of series, I wonder where you think policymakers should sort of start trying to sort of unravel the spaghetti.
Well, I think that I suppose that a choice has to be made in some respects between whether you have you use a framework of property or you use a framework of consent and autonomy, because in some ways they are mutually exclusive. Because if you look at it as a privacy issue or a consent issue under data protection legislation, then you come within, at least within Europe, you come within regulations that are designed by the European Commission for all sorts of data, and they don't carve out any particular exceptions for health, and therefore they don't recognize, I suppose, the very valuable epidemiological use of the data. They don't look at the public interest in medical research and quality assurance and patient safety and all of those very good things that can come out of the use of data. So they just treat all data the same. So I think that that's a bit of a problem, and perhaps there should be a specific Health Data Protection Act that looks at and weighs up the competing interests in that context. And then if you treat it as a property issue, then you're looking at, you know, is a blood spot on a card, for example, is that considered to be tissue? And if so, who owns it? And we go down that road of I suppose, ownership of human biological material and the complexities that raises. So I think that's an initial choice maybe that policymakers have to make. And then, of course, that policy will be open to scrutiny by judicial decision. And then in addition to all of that, of course, you've got to, as I mentioned earlier, I think you've got to really be careful to maintain public trust in the healthcare system and in screening systems and so on. So you've got to have a very good governance framework in place that people can see is open and transparent and accountable and proportionate and all of those things that we require good governance to be. So I think it's not going to be solved very easily, but certainly the concept of destroying what is a very valuable resource, I think, is just something that we need to think through, because once it's lost, then all of the benefit is wasted.
So I particularly like that idea of good governance, that as a meme moving forward, and something I think that we tend not to focus on enough in this country. So just in the minute or two that we have left as we make this demand on your valuable time, Deirdre, let's sort of throw it way open and throw you into the shark tank of prognostication. What are the things that we should be keeping an eye open for over the next 6 months, year or so in Ireland, in Irish healthcare law, in the EU, about emerging issues, about emerging controversies? You've all done a lot of work on physician-assisted suicide, reproductive technologies. I know you've just been awarded a grant by the Medical Council for a study about medical practitioners. What sort of things do you think that we might be talking about in 6 months or a year if we do this again?
Wow, that's a very big question, Nick. I think there's lots of things. I mean, starting with the last one first, where you talked about the Medical Council and professional regulation. I think one of the big issues that's under discussion within Europe is the doctors crossing borders and how to regulate that, I suppose, because within the EU, no member state can discriminate against entry of a medical practitioner into its jurisdiction. So we are obliged to accept doctors from any EU member state, and we're not allowed to, for example, test their language proficiency, their English language proficiency. And of course, that gives rise to lots of difficulties in terms of communication. And it also gives rise to difficulties in, I suppose, tracking and credentialing and privileging, all of those things that are familiar concepts in the United States, because we don't know whether a doctor that we admit from Germany or Poland or France has been the subject of professional disciplinary proceedings within those countries. So I think that that's something that within the EU we're really going to have to tackle, a possible bill of health in some ways who cross border, I think, important. Other issues on, I suppose, the bioethics side, Ireland is a little bit behind the curve in terms of dealing with assisted reproduction. We have been promised legislation in relation to assisted reproduction. Hopefully by the end of this year, we'll see the shape of that, but that will be certainly very controversial in our jurisdiction, as with others. In relation to legal developments in assisted dying, I think it is interesting that we've seen, certainly in the UK, in the last 12 months or so, with the Nicholson case, the court in that case split 7-2 against the assisted suicide of the individuals in that case. But what was interesting was, I think, about five judges in that case implied that the law should be changed. So there is growing support, I think, for legal change in favour of assisted suicide in the UK, perhaps, and maybe to a lesser extent in Ireland. Up to now, I suppose, the assisted suicide cases have failed on grounds of interference with Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which is the right to respect for private and family life. It's been argued that assisted suicide should fall within the right to respect for privacy. And the courts thus far have said, no, this is a matter for each individual member state to decide for itself within its own culture and values. But recent cases, I think, are showing more of a move in the direction of looking at whether a prohibition on assisted suicide is a disproportionate interference with the right to respect for private and family life under Article 8 of the Convention. So we may see some movement in that direction, I think.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Deirdre Madden for joining us on the first Twill International edition. Thanks for joining us, Deirdre.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you.
So we post our show notes at twill.com. Also at twill.com, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. Or if you don't want to give money, you can buy one of the Twill t-shirts, a fine piece of merchandise. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found?
I am at HealthPI on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.